Just a short note before this week's Music Zettel. Most of the content this week was created as flipped learning for a music education class that I'll be talking about. And as such, it was made for video rather than as audio. So it's not of quite the usual high standard of recorded voice that I hope, but I think it's still entirely listenable. I'm sure you'll enjoy it anyway. Cheers.
Music Zettel
with James Humberstone.
Welcome to Music Zettel, a podcast about the future of music education and, in the case of today, a little bit about the past as well. Today's podcast is drawn from a couple of sources. You already know from one of the first episodes that in a subject called Key Approaches in Music Education, I've been looking at teaching chord-based instruments so that teachers have the kind of essential skill of being able to jam with students, support them when they're singing a melody or playing a tune on an instrument that they can quickly bring and immediately start playing on. Heading towards that over the next 4 weeks of lectures, we try to contextualize that by looking at some of the key music education movements, pedagogies of the more recent times. So we've covered Orff, we've covered Kodály, and now we're going to begin today in the 1960s and 70s with the creative music movement. And then we move on to the comprehensive music movement. We look at informal learning. And then finally, we look at multiculturalism, cultural diversity, inclusion, pluralism in music education. So today, I'm going to be talking about the creative music movement. In that, and I'm also drawing a little bit from footage from my MOOC again, my free online course, The Place of Music in 21st Century Music Education. This is all done as part of some filming that I'm doing today for the course, because rather than standing and giving a kind of history lecture, when we've got instruments to learn, chord instruments to learn and jam on, I want to be able for students to listen to that information beforehand, watch a short video, and then push into actually making music and discussing it. I guess the experiential, the constructivist stuff in the class. So, all content from the lecture series itself, here we go. So you've just been watching some footage from Shoreditch School working with composer, educator, teacher, academic, Brian Dennis, the author of a wonderful book that I've got with me here, Experimental Music in Schools. The video was made in 1969 and this book was published around the same time. So what's going on there is that music education, some kind of wacky, crazy 1960s put-in-basin haircut version of music education. Well, the creative music movement started off with composer educators like Brian Dennis. Another very famous one is R. Murray Schafer, working in Canada. You can probably tell from the Dennis accents that that was happening in English schools, if you don't know where Shoreditch is. And the idea behind the creative movement was actually incredibly radical at the time. It was the idea that students would engage with the musical thinking of their time. Now, in this case, composers working in schools. So we are talking essentially the art music, contemporary art music of their time, if you like, even maybe the avant-garde music of their time. But nonetheless, this was still really unusual thinking. Probably the first examples of bringing improvisation and composition as a core part of what was happening in the music classroom and understanding music. Another thing that's great about these early books is that they're asking the big questions about music and music education. So if I grab hold of this lovely tome, R. Murray Schafer's The Thinking Ear, you would see that he gets into the big questions right at the very start. This is actually a compilation of a bunch of different books that he published in the 1960s and 1970s. He gets into the really big questions like, what is music? And, you know, defining that essential stuff. So we look at the creative music movement as the first chance for music education to become truly student-centered. And when we say student-centered, what we mean is that rather than the teacher instructing the student on what they need to know and how to do a particular thing and when to practice it and how to practice it and what the knowledge is that they need to know, that the student gets to discover those things themselves. Now, generally in music education, we're actually quite good at experiential or constructivist learning. We're rather good at it because the way that you get better at music is by doing it. I mean, I just mentioned practice. Even teacher-directed practice is still the student doing, right? But when it comes to things like composition, we've often considered that maybe the composer is some highfalutin genius, and we can't actually touch that. So the idea of putting that in the classroom and students to be at the center of doing it and making it, as you just saw in the video, is quite new. Now, can we see that in our syllabi today? Well, we sure can, because the syllabus here in New South Wales breaks down into three major parts. So we've got performing, listening, and composing. And composing is an equal third of those three things. Although if you think back through your own music education, you may not really identify with the idea that one third of what you did in your music classes at high school was composition. Probably more like 80% listening, performing, 20% or maybe less comp. Anyway, I'm now going to flick over to some content from my MOOC, where I discuss the creative music movement in the context of pluralism, which is a big part of the philosophy of music education here at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. Pluralism in music education really means that we want to accept and look for and teach the sophistication in every music without being at all exclusive of others. We try to avoid values-laden language in the way that we compare one music of one or one musical culture with another. For instance, the obvious way that that would happen in an institution like this is a kind of even just tacit understanding that classical music is somehow more intellectual or more spiritually or soul-nourishing than another kind of music such as jazz or popular music or folk music. So what we try to do instead is accept the idea that music, sound, organized sound passing through time is incredibly sophisticated. All of it is. And in fact, that we can't really critique it and understand it until we understand its cultural backgrounds and derivations anyway. So suggesting that the music we know is better than another music that we have othered, we've said, oh, that other thing, is kind of nonsense, because by othering it, we are showing that we don't understand it. We can't engage with it, therefore we're not capable of critiquing it. So I look in this case as the creative music movement for a model for doing that, and I'll come back to you after this little bit of video.
The creative music movement that formed around teacher composers such as Murray R. Schafer, Brian Dennis and John Painter from the mid-1960s on put not only the creative process but a focus on contemporary composition and new ideas about music at the very centre of musical learning. When I met Richard Gill, he also reiterated the importance of composition in music education.
So the idea is we teach children music so they can make their own music. And in order to make their own music, they look at how other music works. And that's why I'm so obsessed with the idea of a variety in the repertoire. Not all classical, not all pop, not all jazz, not all folk, mixture. There's a fantastic line in Auntie Mame that says, "Life is a banquet, and most of them sons of bitches are out there starving." Now, music is like that. Music is a banquet. Why starve? There's so much out there.
The research tells us that teachers have identities as performers, they have identities as you know, people who are good with theory and oral and things like that. They don't have composers' identities. They don't see themselves as improvisers. So they hate the idea of being asked to teach composition. Mm. How do we combat that?
I write a book. A bestseller. Look, you give them examples. You actually take them in and say, "Guys, here's some ideas for teaching composition." And it really starts with very, very simple improvisation skills, like using the material they've already taught and reorganising that. In fact, in the way, actually, that three-year-olds do naturally. Like, when three-year-olds make that leap into song and text and they start improvising their songs and improvising their texts, that's a goldmine. And people have this idea that composition means a printed piece of music nicely bound. That's not the case. So when a child composes something in English, that's not going to be a novel. So if we can get 10 seconds of music from a kid, we're doing really well. And teachers need to be courageous. They need to be brave and need to take risks. They need to fall over and make mistakes. And then we can start to learn how to teach composition. It's not difficult.
While the creative music movement was focused more on Western art music, especially the experimental or indeterminate ideas of Cage, it was genuinely cross-genre, especially in theory. It was not about pushing contemporary music, rather a way of looking at all music better through the eyes of those involved in contemporary practice. It was, in essence, a move from passive learning to student-centred learning. In its obituary, The Guardian called Painter the most influential figure in music education, and it has been suggested that he revolutionised the music curriculum by moving away from rote learning and towards an emphasis on creativity, imagination, and improvisation. The creative music movement is still evident in the way we endeavour to teach classroom music today. Children are encouraged to be active music makers, composing and improvising just as much as they are playing and listening. Many music syllabuses internationally are testament to just how much the creative movement has changed music education, with composition starting in kindergarten and compositional skills being developed all the way through to the end of high school. This influence gives a broad base for introducing any and all kinds of musical creativity into our classrooms. If there is similarity in the compositional process for art, music, composer and DJ alike, then a way of solving Ethan Hine's criticism of the lack of cultural relevance in the 21st century music classroom may be to focus on these similarities, the similarities Hineson called the basis of all music. Hineson argues that the Music Education Academy rejects supposedly vacuous pop. But are there not elements in popular music that are found in other musics? And might not a creative approach unite them?
So, I'll leave you with the same kind of questions that I guess I'm asking there in the video. What has all this got to do with what we're doing in CAME? Well, we're learning to play instruments, chordal instruments, so that we have that basic skill of being able to accompany our students, that we can quickly grab a chord chart in our classrooms, start strumming away, playing, jamming with our own students, being at the constructivist music-making, composing, improvising centre of our classes. So you can see that what the creative music movement gave us in the 1960s and the 1970s was really a permission to move away from being that didactic teacher, the teacher who stands at the front and delivers information to students, who tells them how to do it and what to do it, and becomes an enabler, somebody who can music with their students, who can draw on their students' own knowledge. And really, that's what Schaeffer does in his books, his early books in the 1960s and 1970s. He actually writes down discussions that he had with his students. And, you know, there's big questions like, what is music? Includes their answers in those. In fact, I love this hilarious little thing from another 1969 book. It's a Schaeffer book called Ear Cleaning. And he makes this little note on one of the very last pages of the book, which kind of reflects that idea of moving from being the teacher to being the enactor, the provoker, the, you know, allowing students to actually be running the show and the learning. And he writes this: when the class was told of John Cage's statement to the effect that there is no such thing as silence, everyone was quiet. They were listening for silence. The only sound to be heard was the swish of one student's pencil as he copied down, "There is no such thing as silence." So, in your workshop this week with Brad, you'll be jamming away on chords, but I hope that you'll find some time at some point to stop and think about what's going on, maybe in the context of Brad's own classroom, maybe in the context of your own learning experiences. We've left you to be pretty student-centered and student-directed by doing this task. And maybe also in the context of engaging with contemporary music and contemporary thinking. Schaeffer and Dennis and others did it with the music of their time that interested them as art music composers, experimentalists, as modernists, avant-garde musicians. But maybe as pluralist music educators, we can draw on lots of other kinds of contemporary music, the music around us, and maybe we can even begin engaging with not just the music of our own cultures, of the music that we're excited in and about, but the music of children's own cultures, the students who we're teaching in our classrooms. Discuss.
Music Zettel was written, presented, and produced by James Humberstone.
Music in this episode was composed by James Humberstone.